Good afternoon and welcome to another episode of Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, your host, and today the topic of our discussion is, will precision medicine work for me? We are joined by Dr. Eric A. Collison and Dr. Luke Gilbert from UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center. On the patient panel to discuss the patient perspective, we have patient advocates Heidi Floyd and Adam Hayden. Welcome to Cure Talks, everyone. So to get the show started, we have with us physician scientist Dr. Eric A. Collison and cancer biologist Dr. Luke Gilbert from UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center. And we are talking about a very complicated subject, which we are going to try and make simple for everybody to listen and realize the burgeoning importance of precision medicine. Dr. Collison, Dr. Gilbert, great to have you with us and welcome once again to Cure Talks.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I want to kick off this discussion with the most basic question to both of you. Can you help us understand what precision or personalized medicine is? Maybe they're both one and the same, or there's a difference. And we'll start with Dr. Collison, and then Dr. Gilbert, you can chime in.
Sure. I can start. I think you mentioned precision medicine and personalized medicine, and I think they're a spectrum of the same phenomenon. Precision medicine, I think, refers to treating the molecular underpinning of a disease, and what Dr. Gilbert and I work on mostly is cancer, and what that means most of the time is a mutant gene or a mutant gene product. And so precision means that we're looking for chemical matter, most often drugs, sometimes other treatments like cells or other proteins that attack the underlying cause precisely. So in contrast to chemicals that kill many different kinds of cells, we would like to be precise in what we do with the treatments we give, and that is called precision medicine. And I think personalized medicine is along that spectrum, but folding in the diagnostic angle, which is increasingly important in the clinic. It was fine years ago to sequence one genome over 20 different centers over 20 years with close to $1 billion. Now our challenge is to do that in one human being in 48 to 72 hours so that we can figure out what mutations that patient's tumor harbors in enough time to get the treatment on board when it's needed. So I think precision medicine is the overarching goal, and personalized medicine is the reduction to practice with the diagnostics in the clinic.
I think from my perspective, I think what cancer biologists do is more precision medicine focused, and what clinician scientists do is both, right?
Yeah.
So we think more about precision medicine on the level of targeting specific mutations or specific tumor genotypes or tumor genetic spectrums, and then the implementation is an enormous challenge, which is something that I'm frankly quite blind to.
So what we're saying that is that precision medicine is an approach to the care of cancer, since we're talking about cancer here, in which we are trying to match probably the best therapy with the optimal patient. And for this, we look at all possible information about the patient and the disease. Is that right?
Eric may disagree with, or Dr. Carlson may disagree with me, but I think precision medicine is a combination of science and medicine, and personalized medicine mm-hmm. is medicine. I don't know. Would you simplify
yeah.
it that far?
Yeah. No. I think that's well said. That the precision we seek to gain is really at the molecular level in cancer. That we want to know the underlying cause, and that's just essentially a scientific enterprise of testing hypotheses. Personalized medicine is you can't always test a hypothesis in the clinic. You've got to practice medicine, and that's both art and science. And personalized medicine falls in that spectrum.
Thank you, Dr. So I'll just ask one more question on the basics before we actually address the topic that we're discussing today, whether am I eligible for precision medicine. So Dr. Collison, it will be great if you can very briefly, you know, this is for the benefit of the audience so they know what we're talking about here, very briefly summarize the kind of therapies that are presently available under the precision medicine umbrella for cancer. Just a brief idea of some terms that probably the listeners are quite familiar with, but would like to hear.
Sure. I'll give three examples, and they'll be brief. And they all include, they all involve therapeutics, because that's usually, if cancer's left alone, unless you treat it with a therapeutic, then it usually ends in death. Not always, but quite often. So we're interested in treating cancer because the results of not doing so are lethal. So the three therapies can be broken down into basically small molecules. So these are drugs like antibiotics or aspirin that many patients are familiar with. They come in pills or in infusions. And these drugs often bind to proteins that we know drive cancer proliferation. So this is the equivalent of a broken accelerator that cannot be lifted off the car floor, and the cancer cell is essentially floored and always accelerating. So if you can design a piece of chemical matter to fit into that accelerator, you can pull it off the floor and get the acceleration to stop. And there are great examples of that Dr. Gilbert uses in his lab. Imatinib for CML, for leukemia, is an example. We have many other examples in melanoma and lung cancer that we work on as well. A second example would be a marker, like a protein on a cancer cell. So it may not drive the cancer cell, but it flags to the therapy that this is a cancer cell. And there, we've been able to attack those markers with antibodies like Herceptin or rituximab. These are antibodies that attack the cancer cell by the identification of this protein on the cancer cell itself, and then the cancer cell gets killed by the immune system. Or increasingly, we skip the middleman, and we make the immune cells ourselves. And this is exciting work happening at UCSF by some of our colleagues, where they actually engineer the patient's own immune cell to attack the cancer through a similar recognition of this cancer-specific epitope. And there, CD19 and other liquid cancers have been successful early examples, but we expect more. So the idea is always to achieve a therapeutic index, meaning that the cancer cell dies, the normal cells don't, based on a molecular lever, meaning that the cancer cells have this thing, the scientists have discovered it and studied it, and then a pharmacologist or other person has figured out how to make a therapy to block it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dr. Collison. Looks like we have already started getting a few questions in my email. So this one I think I'm going to take now. A person wants to know what cancers can be treated with precision medicine. I know you just mentioned leukemia, melanoma, and lymphoma. What else? What are the other cancers that can be treated with precision medicine? This person wants to know.
Sure. Great question. Well, I think at the level of cancer, we're increasingly trying to do the first step in precision medicine that we talked about, at least in personalized medicine, which is diagnosis. We want to achieve precision diagnosis so that we don't get into the scenario where we don't know what this cancer is, we don't know what's driving it, we don't know what's going on. That's obviously not a good starting point. So I will say all cancers, and maybe Dr. Gilbert will disagree, but all cancers are amenable to a precision approach to diagnostics. And that today, I think, includes imaging of the tumor using PET scanning and CT and MRI scanning. These are precision imaging approaches, as well as genomic characterization of all tumors. All tumors have DNA. all tumors have at least one mutation in them, and figuring out the mutations that drive the cancer is a key first step. Then the treatment is the next step, and we have FDA-approved, quote, precision treatments in many diseases, certainly the biggest cancer killers, lung cancer, breast cancer, and colon cancer, all have precision approaches in various degrees. There's still some pretty egregious omissions on that list. Pancreas cancer that we work on a lot in the lab, hepatocellular cancer, these are cancers that kill millions of people worldwide and for which we haven't really made a lot of progress on the precision medicine front yet, although that's changing.
Thank you, Dr. Collison. My next question is to Dr. Gilbert. Dr. Gilbert, what is the difference between genetic and genomic testing and sequencing? The reason why I'm asking this question is when we were just preparing for this talk and getting some feedback from patients, advocates, there seemed to be a big confusion around the difference between these two. It'd be great if you could just clarify this.
Yeah, I think many people do use them interchangeably, and there mm-hmm. are more specific definitions that can be applied. But the confusion in part relates to the fact that as we diagnose cancer, our methods for diagnosing the underlying alterations have changed over the years. And so my definition for this is for genetic testing, you can be looking at a single gene or all genes. And for genomics, sort of by definition, you're looking at thousands of genes or all genes encoded by the genome. And so older tests in the late 90s would, for example, look at a single gene that was known to be associated with cancer and ask, is that gene mutated in an individual patient or a cohort of patients? Where currently we're moving towards not looking at single genes in patient samples, but instead looking at either a large fraction of the genome or the whole genome. So if you're at a cutting-edge cancer institute, often as you enter, you can be given the option to have a test run on all genes known to be associated with cancer, for example. There are companies that do this, like Foundation Medicine. And so we may, because of our change in methodologies, we're losing the what we would have historically defined as genetic medicine, and everything's becoming genomic medicine in my estimation.
Yeah, I would agree. I would add another possible distinction between the two terms, and I agree with Luke that they're used, I don't want to say sloppily, but, you know, these are new terms. The word genomic didn't exist a decade ago, so I think we're trying to fit where it fits. One thing we use in cancer, genetics often refers to the genes you came with, meaning your mom's and your dad's. So germline genetics is a term that's often used. And these are the heritable components of cancer, which we know are many, whereas genomics may refer to the somatic changes, the changes that the cigarettes or the UV rays or the bad luck that your cells had after birth and resulted in a spectrum of mutations that you were not born with. So some people use the term genomics in cancer genomics to say, oh, these are somatic changes. I don't know if this word's in the dictionary yet, actually. Maybe it is.
I'm not sure. Yeah, no, that's well said. That's a nice way of looking at it.
So when we talk about genetic testing, most of the time we're talking about genes that have been inherited from family members. And when we talk about genomic testing, we are talking about our own tumor and somatic changes from our tumor.
Yeah, so to add to that, then your genetics doesn't change over the course of your life, where the genomics mm-hmm. of a tumor can change between your normal cells versus your tumor cells, but also during the course of treatment, a tumor can change. And so you would want to get genomic profiling ideally throughout the course of tumor treatment.
Mm-hmm. So we just had, this question just came in, I think, based on what we're just talking. The question is, will genomic sequencing show if I have a hereditary risk for cancer?
Yeah, it's a great question. Like most tests, you only know what you test, and so some of these panels, they interrogate 50 genes or 90 genes. At UCSF, our in-house panel looks at 500 genes, and there's more than 20,000. I think it's now 28,000 genes in the genome, and we don't sequence all those. But you do inherit all of those times two from your parents. So we think a large amount of cancer risk is inherited, meaning, up to 50% in some cancers and certainly 10% in most common cancers, there's a familial risk component, meaning you're born with it. The genetic tests that we do today identify the major risk genes, but don't identify every gene that impacts risk. So we encourage people who have a family history, meaning mother, father, brother, or sister, to undergo germline testing in most heritable cancers, and those include pancreas, breast, melanoma in some cases, other colon cancer in other cases. So in those patients, we always recommend that you provide a saliva or a blood sample, send it off, see what mutations you have, and if something's found that is suspicious for the cancer that you have, then we work out from there. And if there's the appropriate consent and counseling in place, we talk to the brother, we talk to the mother, we talk to the children about their, usually 50%, but not always, 50% risk of inheriting that allele from you, if that makes sense.
Yes, that does. Dr. Collison, maybe we could just talk a little bit about who is a good candidate to get tested and what exactly do they get tested for and what might you hope would come out of that test?
I'm assuming you mean a germline genetic test, an inheritance test. Yeah. So this is really the Wild West today. I think as recently as about 3 years ago, the answer would have been very easy. If you have breast cancer or ovarian cancer or colon cancer, and you had a family history, then or your tumor looked a certain way under the microscope, in the case of colon cancer, then you should get genetic testing. That's still true. And unassailable and absolutely true. We've now included other cancers under that rubric, prostate cancer, pancreas cancer, others in which we know that there are inherited mutations. So I would say any patient with metastatic prostate cancer, any patient with pancreatic cancer, any patient under 50 with colorectal cancer, any patient with ovarian cancer, and patients under, I believe, 50 with breast cancer of certain kinds should get germline testing, less so for diseases like lung cancer and some brain cancers. But now we're also seeing the direct-to-consumer movement pioneered by Silicon Valley and other places where we're both getting, are you inherited, are you related to Aunt Josephine in Pittsburgh? So a relatedness test to kind of build interesting networks of long-lost cousins, but also spontaneously discovering deleterious cancer genes at the same time. And this is a bit of an ethical struggle of how to deal with these. If this patient just wanted to know, Is she 20% Irish, like mom says, or is she actually from Germany, but actually finds out that she has a 50% chance of getting breast cancer? That's not really what she signed up for. So that's difficult to know how to deal with that. And then a third scenario is there's a bunch of companies coming through that are proposing to build blood tests to actually find cancer before it's clinically evident, and those look very encouraging, but are definitely too early for prime time. But this is a rapidly moving area.
Thank you, Dr. So I believe when we last spoke, we discussed how it's definitely not just about the information. It's what you do with that information. It's about how appropriate treatment is. And when we are especially not sure if the gene mutation will respond or will not respond. So, doctor, do you have to address the situation about appropriateness of selecting treatments? And how do you address this with your patients?
Well, I try to look at first, you know, clinical evidence. Has an experiment been done in patients like this patient with this drug? That's the highest level evidence. But I think there's, unfortunately, the vast majority of the diseases in the cancer clinic today, we don't have good treatments for. And I increasingly look to people like Dr. Gilbert to tell us, you know, what are we not thinking of here in the clinic? I'll let him explain how he finds some new therapies for for cancers, and actually how he figures out how certain drugs we use all the time actually work.
Yeah, so I think as a background piece of information, and Dr. Paulson alluded to this, is the we only defined what the genes are in the human genome at around 2001. So it's been less than, you know, 20 years since we've even known for a single genome what was encoded in our genome. Since then, we've come a long way, due in part to advances in technology, and we've now sequenced hundreds of thousands of healthy individuals from across the globe, which defines what the natural genetic variation in the human population is. We've also looked at many hundreds to thousands of genomes from individual diseases and defined what the genetic alterations are that are associated with individual diseases, not just cancer, Crohn's disease, lupus, all kinds of neurodegenerative diseases. In the context of cancer, we've sequenced hundreds to thousands of genomes from individual cancers, and that number continues to grow. So for any common cancer, we now have a very advanced draft genome of the mutations that are associated with disease at diagnosis. For, I'd say, a fraction of those changes, we as a scientific and medical community have built precision drugs. One of the more recent examples of this is a gene that is called KRAS that's mutated in very commonly in lung cancer, pancreatic cancer, and colon cancer, as well as sporadically in other cancers like leukemias. And it's been a holy grail of thinking of new ways to target this gene. We know this gene drives tumor progression and it drives poor response to conventional therapies. And so our colleagues at UCSF a couple of years ago came up with a really innovative way to target this this protein, and that's progressed through startups and big pharma to a series of molecules that were presented this year at ASCO, which is the main clinical trial conference in the U.S. for cancer therapy, with Amgen announcing that they have pretty dramatic responses in using this molecule to treat lung cancer patients that have a specific mutation. Despite the promise of these approaches, we have a long way still to go. So most of the genetic alterations that we see in an individual patient, we don't have specific precision therapies to target these mutations. And even worse, we often don't even have an advanced understanding of what these genes do or how these genes work together with other changes we see in tumors to drive complex biology within an individual patient. And so there's much to do, and there are many people working very hard on this. I mean, this is the fundamental challenge in cancer biology at this point. Yeah.
Dr. Gilbert, isn't it true that there are reports that confirm that the majority of individuals who have contributed their DNA to genomics research are Caucasians, and therefore minorities underrepresented in the genome database? Can you comment on this as well?
To my understanding, that's absolutely true. The majority of the genomic information we have for cancer is derived from the U.S. or from Europe or to some degree from Japan and China, but that doesn't cover the global spectrum of genetic diversity in humans. We have intentionally collected normal human genome information from across the globe. So we have that part in place, but I think it for sure in the context of many cancers, we don't understand how the mutations that are associated with liver cancer in Southeast Asia are similar or different from the mutations associated with liver cancer in North America. And I bring this up as an example because there are global differences that don't relate necessarily to race, but instead to diet. So there are known toxins associated with peanuts in Southeast Asia that drive mutations in liver cancer, which gives those people in that region of the world a different mutational profile than what we have in the U.S., where we have liver cancers that are more associated with, you know, obesity and alcohol consumption and other influences. So definitely an important, like your whole podcast is pointing out, we need both a precision and a personalized approach here, and that applies to each individual's family history as well as their personal life history.
You know, that's one of the shortcomings of for all the excitement around genomics that we talked about, putting things into the DNA sequencing machine and getting lots of data. That's all very exciting, but what we often forget what we don't gain from that and what we don't fully get out of the sequencing machine is, you know, where did this patient come from? Is this patient born in the U.S.? Does this patient have a virus, you know, that she had as a child? Is this a smoker or a non-smoker? What are the effects of environmental toxins or other practices? And so I think increasingly we're trying to get these well-annotated data sets that go beyond just genomics. So it's putting that cancer genome from that patient in the setting of who she is and how did she grow up and what was her diet like and her exercise like. And it's only with that complete picture that we're able to really educate the next patient. You know, in patients like you with this mutation, we found that a high-fat diet is especially deleterious, for example. We can't make that give that advice if we don't have the dietary information with the genomic information. And that's a major challenge. We're somewhat handcuffed in the medical centers today, unfortunately, due to the privacy with which we all guard our medical information. And that's probably appropriate, certainly for diseases with more social stigma to them. But I think in metastatic cancer, there's a group of us who are trying to loosen those privacy rules, patients being at the front of this charge, and trying to liberate their data for study on a broader scale, to put their genomics in context with who they actually are and get it out there. So that's something we're trying to do more of in the cancer community.
Thank you. I do have some more questions, but I think I need to stop now looking at the time and open it up for our patient panel. So I'm going to hand over to Heidi Floyd. Heidi is breast cancer survivor and advocate. She highlights treatment options, quality of life, and community concerns. Heidi, over to you.
Hi, thank you very much. Thank you, doctors. I just want to say thank you for your work in this field. This is obviously crucial. My first question focuses on accessibility and briefly touches on what Priya had mentioned just earlier. There are so many people groups out there that just simply don't have access to, you know, larger institutions that are conducting this kind of work, but it really is, I mean, it's incandescent and life-changing, this arena. How do you have any ideas how to propose that we can reach the underserved where they are? Simply because if they have cancer, for example, they can't, you know, they have such financial toxicity, they don't have the wherewithal to get to organizations that might be conducting precision medicine. Can you speak to that just briefly?
Yeah, so I think there are really exciting things happening right now in diagnostics where we would measure the genetic or genomic changes associated with an individual tumor. The cost of some of these tests, whether they're DNA sequencing based or I'll highlight another version, have dropped dramatically. There's a specific startup company I'm thinking of as an example that is leveraging new enzymes, so not DNA sequencing, but a new form of a test that relies on specific enzymes that we can harvest from bacteria that can we can program to detect mutations. And this has been demonstrated in field trials in Africa to be able to differentiate between different subtypes of Ebola, or in Southeast Asia, between dengue subtypes, as well as in the U.S. To differentiate between different serotypes of HPV that are associated with cervical and head and neck cancer. And the appeal of these approaches is that they're very low cost, and they can be done in the field with no specialized equipment. So the estimated cost right now for these tests is about $10. No specialized equipment, no refrigeration. You get results within a half an hour. So if we can implement these at scale, and we turn this from a small startup of 10 people, I'm not financially involved in any way, so I'm not trying to plug that for that, just to be full disclosure. I think that these enzymatic tests can be implemented in any clinic across the world, really. And I think that would be amazing for medicine outside of North America.
Yeah, and I'll just to speak to that question, I think, you know, what we don't see often is the etiology, the cause of the cancers that we think we know a lot about in other countries. One of my colleagues, Catherine Van Loon, here at the UCSF Cancer Center, goes to Tanzania twice a year, every year. She's a medical oncologist, and we've now sequenced 200 genomes from Tanzanian squamous cell esophageal cancer here at UCSF. And, you know, we think that some of the causes of esophageal cancer in Africa may be different than those here in the U.S. And so I think at a very fundamental level, this isn't the kind of high-tech, fancy, state-of-the-art kind of medical center you think about, but actually using the power of the technology to go global, as Dr. Gilbert's alluding to, is really the first step, to use technology to pull these populations up to a minimal standard of care and then building on that.
Going global, would that not be just fantastic? What a dream. I had a question, but based on what – I can't remember which one of you said this earlier. I kind of want to dive into this instead. One of you – we were talking about the quote was exactly, we guard our medical info. We're really tight on that because of the, you know, different laws and everything here in this country, but we want to liberate our data. I'm not sure which one of you was talking, you know, which one of Dr. Eric or Dr. Luke, but it was – that was brilliant to me. As a patient, as a two-time – someone who's been diagnosed with cancer two times, going into, let's say a patient is going into a surgery ahead of time and they know that, you know, they've been diagnosed with cancer, now they're going in to remove their tumor or tumors. What, if the onus were on the patient, what can we do before we go in to say, we want to free this tumor? I want to make sure that all the precision medicine that needs to be done on it can be done so that you can dive in and, you know, all the functional testing, make sure that you test those tumors with, you know, outside drugs, you know, so I know what will work. Is there something that we as a patient can do before we go into those surgeries so that we get precision medicine?
Yeah, so there are a few of these projects that are growing. My colleague Nikki Wagel at Dana-Farber has a great project in breast cancer called the MBC, Metastatic Breast Cancer Project, where patients are consented and they send their tumors in. And he and his colleagues in Boston sequenced that tumor, and a proviso of participating, I believe, is that data becomes public. And so the germline component is kept private, but the somatic mutations are shared with the public, so that clever researchers in the Czech Republic, for example, who may not be hanging out in Harvard Square that afternoon, can have access and think about those data. We're aspiring to that in other diseases, pancreas cancer being one of them. And it is a delicate balance because a lot of these diseases, like we just talked about, have a very strong family risk. So it's fine if the patient says, yeah, I want to share my data, but that doesn't mean her daughter feels the same way or her sister feels the same way. And, you know, genes are tricky things. They get mutated in cancer, but they also get shared in families. So finding the right spot between transparency and privacy is something we just need communication. We just need dialogue. And I feel, unfortunately, we've kind of locked down the dialogue a little bit too much on the privacy side with some of the election shenanigans. But hopefully that will open back up and we can actually have a civil discourse on this topic.
I agree completely. As a very passionate patient advocate and, you know, a breast cancer community organizer, how can my little narrowly focused group, what can we do to help both of you as this progresses and the other groups that are out there in the precision medicine space, you know, everybody that's out there working on testing everything, what can we do to help you?
That's a tough question. You know, there are a lot of these trials coming up that have to do more with you. You know, what can we do to help you as the breast cancer patient, survivor, et cetera? I think we haven't done as good of a job beyond saying, you know, send a check. Of what can we actively do to enroll patients? Some colleagues at UC Santa Cruz are trying to gather all the BRCA alleles called the BRCA Challenge. I'd encourage you to Google that. And it is especially for you know Asian women with breast cancer who don't happen to be Ashkenazi Jewish. They have an allele of the BRCA1 or 2 gene that looks like it might be cancer, but we don't sequence a lot of Vietnamese women, so we're not quite sure what to do with this. And so it's through this kind of crowdsourcing approach that we're trying to adjudicate what alleles are deleterious, and that's very much community driven. In other diseases, we're also trying to certainly support each other, you know, more through traditional meals and rides to clinics and donating rooms so people can participate in clinical trial. But I do agree we need to be more activist on the genomics side, and we're trying to build the infrastructure for that.
Very good. Well, I'd love to stay connected with you. If I could do anything to help, please consider me at your disposal.
Well, thanks for so much you already do.
I would add, at a national level, a lot of the research in medicine, research in science and research in medicine is funded by American taxpayers. And so I think 60 years ago there was, or 50 years ago there was a decision by politicians and American citizens to fund cancer research, and this is worth it. We've made a lot of progress, but I'd say it's been reassuring over the last couple of years that commitment to cancer research has been renewed or is continuing to be renewed, but it's something that politicians do need to hear that people care about, right? And it's important to communities.
Yeah, it is pretty incredible in 2019 that there's any topic with universal agreement. But I would say that supporting cancer research, you know, from the far right to the bleeding left, both are firmly supportive, and there's just no disagreement on that topic.
Yeah. Full disclosure, I sit on the Department of Defense Grants Review Board for Cancer Research, and I did not pay you to say that. It is just absolutely wonderful.
Good, yeah. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thanks for your service, too.
So I have a question about functional testing. If they test a tumor outside, like during surgery, what is the accuracy level when they do the testing that they know if a drug will work inside the patient, you know, if it's outside the patient versus inside?
That is a really challenging question. What I tell people is that everything except for a real human tumor is a model, and we've learned a lot from models, from simple models and from complicated models, but in the end, any model doesn't recapitulate the complexity of a tumor in a human. And so I think we've come a long way in our understanding of how to use various models to predict drug efficacy, but it's you know, it is one of the central challenges of cancer research is how to pick appropriate models, and it's a balance of complexity and cost and throughput and which questions you want to ask. It's very, very, very challenging.
Yeah, I will say, you know, I'm a consumer. I like trying new things as an oncologist, and I like gadgets and new tests. I will say I haven't seen a commercial product that proposes to grow cells and treat them in a way that I think is currently clinically useful. That certainly doesn't mean it will never be a true statement, but today I don't think we're there yet. And that's largely because it's kind of at least two problems. It's one is getting the cells to grow, which is not at all trivial. And then second is the testing you do on the cells predictive of what's going to actually have to happen. And unfortunately, that's a conditional question. If they don't grow, then you can't even ask the second question. And we've learned that not all cells grow and that is not random. So some of the patients in whom we most need this kind of a service, again, pancreas cancer, for example, are actually pretty tough to grow in a dish compared to, leukemia cells, for example, which can be grown relatively easily. I think it's a promising model. I will add that a lot of Luke's research is a similar version of functional testing where he actually tells us on a genetic level what kind of mutation should we expect if this therapy works and then the cancer recurs. So that's another kind of functional analysis where we're using a known medicine, but we know it's not going to work forever, and I think Luke's research actually tells us what trouble lies ahead so that we can plan the next therapy appropriately, and that's another functional medicine that is very helpful.
Or even better, as best-case scenario, our research predicts for new medicines how they should be combined with existing medicines to have synergistic anti-cancer activity. And so one of my goals is to continue working with clinicians, scientists, and chemists to build innovative medicines that are really non-toxic, which enables them to be combined with other therapies. So going back to this KRAS example that I highlighted, this drug in people or in animal models is completely non-toxic. It's safer than Tylenol or aspirin. They've never hit a dose-limiting toxicity in people. And so that's my 2019 example of the direction we want to be going in cancer biology.
Absolutely.
Non-toxic, those are like words to my ears, having been through so many different types of chemotherapies. That's amazing. I was speaking recently at a clinical trials event in Philadelphia, and one of the questions kind of surrounded what I mentioned earlier about underserved populations and how they, you know, may or may not be reticent to come forward or simply can't come forward. Can you kind of just elucidate the steps we've taken? I know that we kind of, the pendulum has swung pretty far about keeping privacy and things like that, but how far have we come from the Henrietta Lacks situation where we're not going to do anything nefarious with your tumors, but we really want to help you? Can you kind of just speak about what has been put in place to encourage people to participate?
Yeah, sure. I will say there's more sticks than there are carrots. Unfortunately, today. So it is against the law to discriminate against people based on a mutation they have, and that means I can't refuse to insure you based on a mutation, for example. I can't not give you a job because you have a mutation in gene X, and that's a fine law to enact and well intended. Unfortunately, it's not totally symmetrical with what Luke and I are telling you today, right? We were just talking about privacy and the laws preventing genomic privacy, requiring non-discrimination based on genetics. And at the same time, Dr. Gilbert and I are telling you that it's genetics that causes all this stuff or a great deal of it. So at some point, it's certainly not all genetics, but to say that genetics is equal amongst everyone and that there is no increased risk in person A versus B is just scientifically not true. So I don't think we've had a high-level discussion over how to reasonably factor in genetic risk into things like insurance premiums and stuff like that. It is clearly non-zero, but our laws today assume that it is zero. And I think we need to have a bit of a more mature discussion over that.
I agree.
Thank you, Heidi. We have some questions that are coming in from our listeners, so probably we'll just go over those as well. Now, one of the questions is, Dr. Collison and Dr. Gilbert, how affordable is genetic and genomic sequencing, and what is the attitude of the insurance companies to cover these costs? I think we're getting a bunch of questions on the cost of precision medicine right now.
So if the technologies continue to change, like Dr. Collison said, to sequence the first human genome was more than $1 billion. The last estimates that I've heard for sequencing all of the genes in your genome currently is roughly $1,000,
mm-hmm.
a little less than $1,000 maybe,
mm-hmm.
and it's anticipated that that should continue to drop over the next 2 or 3 years. I think a good goal would be, you know, closer to $100.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to sequence all of the genome. So we can save costs by sequencing a part of the genome that we know is highly correlated with the disease. So in certain cancers, we know that, say, 95% of patients have these 100 mutations, and we can just sequence those 100 genes and gather most of the information we need. And then, like I said, there are even newer technologies that don't use sequencing, but instead use other enzymes and other newer methods to get at part of this information.
Yeah, and I'll say, just because I think the listener asked for dollar amounts, U.S. dollar amounts, to do a germline test, what genes were you born with, you know, that the Internet will sell you that for around $100, and those tests are not horrible. They're not medical grade per se. The medical grade versions of those with all the insurance and stuff often goes up to around 1,000. The cancer tests we're talking about with lots of genes is usually closer to 2,000 to 5,000. And the other part of the question was, what does insurance pay for that? And the answer is it depends. And it really depends on whether the disease, lung cancer often reimbursed, colon cancer sometimes. It's really adjudicated on the insurance level by what disease the testing's being done in, because a lot of our reimbursement's still built on, you know, the lung cancer module versus the colon cancer module, whereas I think a lot of us oncologists think more about mutations than diseases of origin, but we try to do both.
I think the related answer to this sort of vein of questions is how much. So diagnosis is one part, but how much do the therapies cost,
mm-hmm.
For precision medicine? And there, that in some ways is a discussion between the drug makers and the individual countries that they're being applied to. And so you see discrepancies in cost between countries that relate to the negotiation between, you know, for-profit companies and national governments. There's a subtlety to this as well that, in my opinion, science sort of is designed to show you what could be done, and then it's up to engineers and production and other means to scale this to be able to treat like a global population. And so in some of the things that we're talking about today, like cellular therapies, are currently extraordinarily expensive. And my hope is that as they're proven to be useful and as they're scaled up, we'll find clever ways to decrease the costs. But that remains to be seen.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So we have Adam with us now. Adam Hayden is a brain tumor advocate and survivor, and he is actually, his personal blog called Glioblastology is a popular peer-to-peer resource and is in syndication with the Cancer Health magazine. Adam, please ask your questions.
Terrific. Thanks so much. And I was speaking into the abyss, so it's nice to hear your voice, Priya. And Heidi, nice to share the panel with you. I'm going to just, play off of what we were just discussing around cost. So the cost of therapeutic and CAR T cell therapy, et cetera. We know it's extraordinarily expensive, and we've had some good news that CMS is going to cover some of that, so hopefully we'll move in that direction. But I want to ask actually the flip of this. So last year, Siddhartha Mukherjee wrote a cool piece for New York Times Magazine saying that you can compare two blood-thinning medications after heart attack. One costs $6 a pill, the other is a quarter a pill. He said that things like using the tools of genomics might help us prescribe a cheaper medication when it will be as effective in some patient populations as opposed to others. So that was a call for cost savings through what I take to be personalized medicine. So I'd love you just to remark on, you know, is there an opportunity for savings in the long run around this practice of medicine?
I'll comment on that. This is Eric. I think yes. You're talking about efficacy, and that's certainly appropriate. You know, does this drug work better than the other drug? I would add even a more obvious and first baby step layer. In medical oncology, what I do is I talk to a patient about their treatment. We're going to do X. We're going to put our head down, walk uphill in the snow for 2 months, and then we're going to do another set of scans and see if the tumor shrinks. And if it does, then we'll keep doing that. And if it doesn't, we'll do something else. And so that's fine, but that takes 2 months, and these things are charged by the dose. That's often, you know, 4 to 8 doses of this medicine at $2,000 to $5,000 a pop, and these things add up. What if we could tell after one dose with a blood draw rather than waiting 2 months? So I think that's an emergent area where actually precision diagnostics might prevent expensive, ineffective therapy much more quickly than the slower diagnostics we use today, which are insurance reimbursed. So paradoxically, it may be cost effective to pay more for diagnostics to save less on drugs, to save more on drugs. And then the other example I'll let Luke comment on, I think he's found many times that a cheap drug actually in a given genetic system works better than an expensive one, and that bias is really in the system here.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is that the way drugs are approved is based off of their activity across a diverse set of patients. So you need to show efficacy in a given disease, or at least within a given disease subtype, which often I think obscures exceptional responders and exceptional non-responders who don't benefit at all from a given drug. And so a lot of my research is around trying to explore this using models, because it's very difficult to design. Eric will have to correct me here, but we don't usually design personalized clinical trials at a single person level, or I don't know how you would design that. And so this is an ongoing science and medicine problem that has sort of legal FDA ramifications too. How do you prove something is effective and safe for an individual versus a population of patients?
Yeah, and there's been some really exciting approaches to that from some of our colleagues in the UC system. The UC San Diego group, for example, had published an interesting paper using given one patient, you know, Susie Q down in San Diego. She got first treatment X, and then she got treatment Y, and it's the same person. And if she was on treatment X longer than treatment Y, then maybe it's fair to compare treatment X and Y with her genome and say this is kind of a clinical trial of one person, but done sequentially rather than simultaneously. There's caveats to that, right? The tumor's grown in that ensuing time, and it may not be a fair comparison. But I think we're learning ways to do these single patient and personalized trials as we go.
Okay, terrific. So here's within the world of brain tumor and brain cancer advocacy, what we see sometimes is that our newly diagnosed patients or not yet diagnosed patients will show up at the emergency department with some emergent symptom of seizure or something, and oftentimes are sort of admitted and whisked into the standard of care protocol quickly, making them ineligible for newly diagnosed clinical trials or unable to spend the time on the diagnostic screening that you're addressing. So I'm curious, something we think a lot about in the advocacy community is, you know, how do we help folks that are not yet even diagnosed understand options before pursuing with a standard of care protocol when something more precise may be appropriate or available. Could you remark on just in the settings of clinical care, how do we better inform people to make these choices?
Yeah, so it's a huge problem. We have the same thing in pancreas cancer, this late presentation problem. My colleague Brian Wolpen at Dana-Farber presented some really compelling data looking, teaching a robot how to look at CT scans through the whole partner's health system. And it was really exciting that they could actually find, you know, some cases of pancreas cancer before just on the imaging that they had done for other reasons. And so where I think this puck is going is that we're going to have systems working in the background while the radiologists are still going to have a job. There are going to be, you know, computers looking at the brains of these people and setting off alarms when there's a tumor seen, hopefully to the glioblastoma network, and that will trigger let's get the consent team down there in real time, kind of on the equivalent of the 2019 back phone to consent them in real time. I can't think of another way of doing it because we just can't post an advocate in every emergency room 24/7.
That's exciting work, and I love the bat phone.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess picking up the glioblastoma bat phone, I'm not sure that's good or bad. That's terrific. One other thing that actually just came up during the discussion, and we talked a little bit about the KRAS case earlier. You know, I'm curious, do you think that are we moving already in the direction of treating the molecular profiles rather than the tissues of origin when trying to better understand treatment plans? It seems like we had some conversations, so I'd just like to hear more about that.
So I think that idea was popularized, that we can move away from a tissue-based understanding of disease towards just a molecular profile. I sort of disagree with this idea. I don't think it's been borne out. In some cases it has, in many cases it hasn't. And so I think that we need to consider the molecular profile of a given tumor type and stratify our treatment decisions based off that, but I'd love to know what Eric thinks.
Yeah, I agree. I think the bloom is not entirely off the rose on that, but it's not a slam dunk. And glioblastoma is a perfect example where we had drugs to treat some of the common mutations that we saw in lung cancer and glioblastoma, but it just turns out due to, you know, brain penetration and the biologies being different, they just weren't as successful in glioblastoma as they were in lung cancer. And to be honest, we didn't really ever figure out why. We're still working on that. So I think, as with all breakthroughs, it comes with footnotes, and to really know it, you got to read the whole book and get to the bottom of it and keep going. So we're getting there. We do have, you know, medicines that are used across cancers. Gastric cancer and breast cancer share mutations. Melanoma and colon cancer have FDA-approved drugs that are the same. But how well they work and how they're combined with other drugs differs.
Great. Terrific.
Thank you. It's kind of time to wrap up now, but I have just one more question because this is exciting. I believe Dr. Collis and Dr. Gilbert, you folks have just recently moved into the new UCSF Center, which is exclusively for precision medicine. So it would be great if you could let us know what the new center offers in terms of trials, research, etc., and then we can wrap it up.
Well, it's a beautiful building. We moved in it's been a month now, and I've had about four or five clinics in the new building. I think some of the perks are that every room has, every level has its own treatment level there, so you can actually see the patients getting the treatment on the same floor. Often they'll go away and we won't see them again until the next visit, 2 weeks. So that's a nice feature, and also the intermingling of different professions, radiation oncology surgeons. Are much more interspersed than they have been, and I think that's the key to success in these diseases, the multidisciplinary approach.
I would add that I think there's one thing that may be missing here is that I've never set foot in this building. And so we need to get that rich history of intermixing basic researchers who are not MDs with clinician scientists. And so I think that our current the cancer research building is a wonderful mix of PhD, MD, and MD-PhD scientists. And I think I should go over to the new cancer building and, say
lunch.
Hi.
We'll buy lunch.
Yeah, my failure, not theirs.
This is great. Congratulations to both of you to be in a new building now. So thank you so much. More than a decade ago, the science fiction author William Gibson said, "The future is here." And it's just that it's not evenly distributed. And the statement, I feel, could just as easily be applied to the field of physician medicine. And as we continue to explore and learn more, the future is definitely brighter with improved understanding and breakthrough therapies for cancer. Dr. Gilbert, Dr. Collison, thank you so very much for sharing all this information with us today. Thank you for your time. Heidi and Adam, thanks a lot for your participation and bringing the patient's perspective into the discussion. And we also thank the UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center and the audience. Thank you and have a great day.